That was a rewarding time for Rathbun. But as soon as he got off the ship after his time away, Miscavige called him into his office and said, "I finally know who my SP is. The 2 years you were gone was the only uninterpolated time in my life." He ordered him to Clearwater, his rank broken, as a trainee. That didn't last either. A number of tabloid sensations arose surrounding Scientology celebrities. Lisa Marie Presley was divorcing Michael Jackson. Kirstie Alley was divorcing actor Parker Stevenson. And Miscavige again turned to Rathbun to cool the press down. Then, on December 5, 1995, a Scientologist named Lisa McPherson died following a mental breakdown. She had rear-ended a boat that was being towed in downtown Clearwater, Florida, near the church's spiritual headquarters. When paramedics arrived, she stripped off her clothes and wandered naked down the street. She said she needed help and was taken to a nearby hospital. Soon afterward, a delegation of 10 Scientologists arrived at the hospital and persuaded McPherson to check out against doctor's advice. McPherson spent the next 17 days under guard in room 174 of the Fort Harrison Hotel. For Scientologists, McPherson's mental breakdown presented a confounding dilemma. McPherson had been declared clear just 3 months before, after 10 years of courses and auditing and substantial contributions to the church. The process had been like a gopher being pulled through a garden hose, she later said, but it had been worth it. "I am so full of life, I am overwhelmed at the joy of it all," she wrote. Wow! Clears are supposed to be invulnerable to mental frailty. People on the base knew that McPherson had been acting strangely before her breakdown. Marty Rathbun, who was at Flag Base during this time, remembers seeing McPherson screaming in the hallways of the Fort Harrison Hotel because she had just been declared clear. "Ah! Yahoo!" she cried. She looked insane. How did she get to be clear when she was obviously irrational? And who was responsible for deciding that she had achieved that state? According to Rathbun and several other former church officials who were present at the time, the case supervisor who pronounced Lisa McPherson clear was David Miscavige. He had gone to Flag in the summer of 1995 to take over the auditing delivered at the base. He would also supervise the treatment of McPherson that followed. Footnote. According to a church spokesperson, Mr. Miscavige was not involved in any aspect of Ms. McPherson's spiritual progress in Scientology. End footnote. When McPherson entered room 174, she was a lovely, shapely young woman. She underwent an introspection rundown, the same procedure that Hubbard had developed on the Apollo 2 decades earlier to treat psychotic behavior. It involved placing McPherson in solitary confinement and providing her with water, food, and vitamin supplements. All communication had to be in writing. Instead of calming down, McPherson stopped eating. She screamed. She clawed her attendants. She spoke in gibberish. She fouled herself. She banged her head against the wall. Staff members strapped her down and tried to feed her with a turkey baster. On December 5th, McPherson slipped into a coma. When church members decided to take her to the hospital that night, they bypassed the Morton Plant Hospital just down the street, where McPherson had originally been seen, and drove her 45 minutes away, passing 4 other hospitals, to the Columbia New Port Richey Hospital, where there was a doctor affiliated with the church. The woman they finally wheeled into the emergency room was skeletally thin and covered with scratches, bruises, and dark brown lesions. She was also dead. She had suffered a pulmonary embolism on the way to the hospital. In the eyes of the world press, Scientology had murdered Lisa McPherson. She was one of 9 Scientologists who had died under mysterious circumstances at the Clearwater facility. The night after McPherson died, Rathbun got word from church officials to wait for a call at a payphone at a nearby Holiday Inn. "Why aren't you all over this mess?" Miscavige demanded when Rathbun answered the call. "The police are poking around. Do something." Rathbun discovered that church officials in Clearwater had already lied in 2 sworn statements to the police, claiming that McPherson hadn't been subjected to an introspection rundown. The church's official response, under Rathbun's direction, was to continue to lie, stating that McPherson had been at the church's Fort Harrison Hotel only for rest and relaxation, and there was nothing unusual about her stay. In the meantime, Rathbun went through the logs that McPherson's attendants had kept. As many as 20 people had been rotating in and out of McPherson's room. Some of them were scratched and bruised from trying to subdue her. That was hardly the isolation and absolute silence and calm that the introspection rundown called for. Rathbun noted that, among other entries in the logs, one of the caretakers admitted that the situation was out of control and that McPherson needed to see a doctor. In the presence of a Scientology lawyer, Rathbun handed several of the most incriminating logs to a church executive and said, "Lose 'em." The McPherson case loomed over the church for 5 years, with an ongoing police investigation, protests in front of Scientology facilities, lawsuits on the part of the family, and endless unwanted press. Embarrassing details emerged, including the fact that McPherson had spent $176,700 on Scientology services in her last 5 years, but she had died with only $11 in her savings account. Rathbun and Mike Rinder, the church's spokesman, were responsible for managing the situation, but Miscavige supervised every detail. The level of tension was nearly unbearable. Rinder had the particularly unrewarding task of defending the church to the public. He was articulate and seemingly unflappable, and he had a talent for disarming hostile interviewers. He had been a Scientologist since he was 5 years old, in South Australia, when the religion was banned. He had sailed with Hubbard aboard the Apollo. Few had a deeper experience of the religion than he, and no one was more publicly identified with it. But even Rinder could not quell the furor that arose from the McPherson affair. Perhaps because of Rinder's lifelong service to the church, Miscavige saw him as a rival, or perhaps the leader's frustration with the continual bad press made his spokesperson a particular object of his wrath. At any rate, Marty Rathbun got a call from Shelley Miscavige around Christmas in 1997, the first year of the protests over Lisa McPherson's death. Rathbun was back at Gold Base. Shelley said that Dave wanted him to report to his quarters right away. Rathbun rushed down the hill to Miscavige's bungalow, where Shelley was waiting just outside the screen door. A moment later, Mike Rinder, who had also been summoned, came racing around the corner of the house. According to both men, the screen door suddenly flew open, and Miscavige came out wearing a terry cloth bathrobe. According to Rathbun and Rinder, Miscavige hit Rinder in the face and stomach, then grabbed him around the neck and slammed him into a tree. Rinder fell into the ivy, where Miscavige continued kicking him several times. Footnote: the church denies that Miscavige has abused any members of the church, saying that the abuse claims have been propagated by a group of vociferous anti-Scientologists. End of footnote. Rathbun just stood there, stunned and puzzled about why he had been ordered to watch this display. Afterward, he decided that he was there to back up Miscavige in case Rinder had the nerve to resist. He was the silent enforcer. Rathbun's management of the defense in the McPherson case was one of his most successful accomplishments for the church. The medical examiner in the case, Joan Wood, had vehemently denied the church's assertion that Lisa McPherson's illness and death were sudden. Her health had obviously deteriorated over a long period. She had been without liquids for at least 5 days, the medical examiner told a reporter, saying, "This is the most severe case of dehydration I've ever seen." She ruled that the cause of death was undetermined, and the state of Florida filed criminal charges against the church. If the church were to be convicted of a felony, it could lead to the loss of its tax exemption and then its probable extinction. Miscavige and his team brought to bear Scientology's two greatest assets, money and celebrity. The church was building up a strong defense in its case by hiring some of the most prestigious medical examiners and forensic scientists in the country. Experts who questioned Joan Wood's conclusion that the likely cause of death was a blood clot caused by dehydration. One of the local lawyers retained by the church arranged a personal meeting between Miscavige and Wood's attorney, Jeffrey Goodis. Miscavige and Rathbun made a number of presentations to Goodis, trying to persuade him that his client was in legal jeopardy because of her ruling in the McPherson case. Wood was known as an unflappable witness and a formidable opponent to defense attorneys. Her testimony would be crucial if the case went to trial. Rathbun says that Miscavige repeatedly warned Goodis that the church was going to discredit his client and sue her into the Stone Age. 4 months before the McPherson case was set to go to trial, Joan Wood changed her ruling to say that McPherson's death was accidental. The state's case collapsed. Charges against the church were dropped, and Wood avoided a lawsuit. Wood retired and became a recluse. She told the St. Petersburg Times that she suffered panic attacks and insomnia. She died of a stroke in 2011. The civil case against the church on the part of McPherson's family continued, however, along with the negative publicity. Tom DeVocht, who was head of the Flag land base in Clearwater, says he arranged a meeting with Mary Repper, an influential political consultant who had led the campaigns of many of the state and local officials in the area, including the state attorney who had filed the criminal charges against the church. Repper had the reputation of being anti-Scientology, but she agreed to have lunch with Rinder, Rathbun, and Miscavige at the Fort Harrison Hotel. It turned out that she was a fan of the soap opera star Michelle Stafford, who was a Scientologist. Repper was invited to Los Angeles to meet her at a Celebrity Center gala. When she returned, Repper began hosting a series of dinners and lunches for local officials to meet other Scientology celebrities. Tom Cruise dropped by Repper's house on several occasions to enjoy her famous coconut cake and schmooze with local officials, including the mayor of Tampa and influential lawyers and judges. He showed clips of his movies and testified about how Scientology had changed his life. Fox News commentator Greta Van Susteren provided sunset cruises on her yacht. Repper held a brunch for Michelle Stafford. The guests were mainly women who were fans of The Young and the Restless, including the secretaries of local judges. Meantime, the church threw black tie galas in the ballroom of the Fort Harrison Hotel, where Edgar Winter, Chick Corea, or Isaac Hayes would perform. The Pinellas County Sheriff attended these events, along with the mayors of Clearwater and Tampa, as well as a number of lawyers and judges who had been targeted by the church as community leaders. Rathbun says that when Miscavige learned that Jeffrey Goodis and his wife were big fans of John Travolta, they were invited to a gala at the Fort Harrison Hotel, and Travolta was asked to thank them for their help. Rathbun says the star was told, "This guy is really going to bat for us." The church poured money into local charities. According to Rathbun and Rinder, the idea was to change the climate of public opinion and thereby influence the attitude of the courts toward the church. Rathbun says there was a parallel campaign to discredit Lisa McPherson's family as gold diggers who were exploiting their daughter's death. In a recent deposition, Rathbun estimated that the entire campaign to shut down the prosecution of the church cost over $20 to $30 million. The civil suit brought by the family settled for an undisclosed sum in 2004. Scientology was under attack elsewhere in the world as well. Germany, acutely sensitive to the danger of extremist movements, viewed Scientology with particular alarm. In Hamburg in 1992, the state parliament created a commission to investigate destructive groups, a category that included the Church of Satan, Transcendental Meditation, and the Unification Church, but was mainly aimed at Scientology. Scientologists were barred from holding government jobs and forbidden to join Germany's main political party, the Christian Democratic Union, because they weren't considered Christians. The youth wing of the party organized boycotts of Cruise's first Mission Impossible and Travolta's movie Phenomenon. The city of Stuttgart canceled a concert by Chick Corea when it was discovered that he was a Scientologist. 70% of Germans favored the idea of banning the organization altogether. The 1990s saw the rise of apocalyptic movements in many different countries. As the millennium drew near, the theme of science fiction and UFOs became especially pronounced and deadly. In October 1994, police in Switzerland, investigating a fire in a farmhouse, discovered a hidden room with 18 corpses wearing ceremonial garments arranged like spokes in a wheel. Other bodies were found elsewhere on the farm. Their heads were covered with plastic bags. Some had been shot or beaten. The next day, three chalets burned in another Swiss village. Investigators found more than 24 bodies in the ruins. They had been poisoned. Some of the dead had been lured to the scene and murdered, but most were followers of Joseph de Mambro, a French jeweler, who had created a new religion, the Order of the Solar Temple. De Mambro's chief lieutenant, a charismatic Belgian obstetrician named Luc Journet, preached that after death the members would be picked up by a spaceship and reunited on the star Sirius. Like Hubbard, Journet had been influenced by Aleister Crowley and the Ordo Templi Orientis. A year after these macabre incidents, the burned corpses of 16 other members of the group were found in Grenoble, France. Then, in 1997, five more members of the order burned themselves to death in Quebec, making a total of 74 deaths. In contrast to the Branch Davidians or the followers of Jim Jones, who were predominantly lower class, the members of the Solar Temple were affluent, well-educated members of the communities they lived in, with families and regular jobs, and yet they had given themselves over to a mystical science fiction fantasy that turned them into killers, suicides, or helpless victims. In March 1995, adherents of a Japanese movement called Om Shinrikyo, Supreme Truth, attacked five subway trains in Tokyo with sarin gas. 12 commuters died. Thousands more might have if the gas had been more highly refined. It was later discovered that this was just one of at least 14 attacks the group staged in order to set off a chain of events intended to result in an apocalyptic world war. The leader of the group, Shoko Asahara, a blind yoga instructor, combined the tenets of Buddhism with notions drawn from Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy, which depicts a secretive group of scientists who are preparing to take over the world. Many of Asahara's followers were indeed scientists and engineers from top Japanese universities who were enchanted by this scheme. They purchased military hardware in the former Soviet Union and sought to acquire nuclear warheads. When that failed, they bought a sheep farm in Western Australia that happened to be atop a rich vein of uranium. They cultivated chemical and biological weapons such as anthrax, Ebola virus, cyanide, and VX gas. They had used such agents in previous attacks, but failed to create the kind of mass slaughter they hoped would bring on civil war and nuclear Armageddon. Still, Om exposed the narrow boundary between religious cultism and terror, which would soon become more obvious with the rise of Al-Qaeda. A spokesperson for the Church of Scientology in New Zealand explained that the source of Om Shinrikyo's crimes was the practice of psychiatry in Japan. Just as the debate in Germany was coming to a climax, in March 1997, 39 members of a group calling itself Heaven's Gate committed suicide in a San Diego mansion. They apparently had hoped to time their deaths in order to ascend to a spacecraft that they believed was following Comet Hale-Bopp. Marshall Applewhite, their leader, a former choir master, represented himself as a reincarnated Jesus who was receiving guidance from the television show Star Trek. Although Scientology has persecuted its critics and defectors, it has never engaged in mass murder or suicides. However, the public anxiety surrounding these sensational events added to the rancor and fear that welled up in Germany. Could Scientology also turn violent? There were elements mixed into these various groups that resembled some features of Scientology, magical beliefs and science fiction being the most obvious. Past lives were a common theme. Like Om Shinrikyo, Scientology has ties to Buddhist notions of enlightenment and Hindu beliefs in karma and reincarnation. Structurally, Om Shinrikyo was the most similar to Scientology, having both a public membership and a cloistered clergy, like the Sea Org, called renunciates, who carried out directives that the larger organization knew little or nothing about. When the attacks on the subway took place, Om's membership in Japan was estimated to be about 10,000, with an additional 30,000 in Russia and some scattered pockets worldwide, with resources close to $1 billion, figures that compare with some estimates of Scientology today. What separated these groups from Scientology was their orientation toward apocalypse and their yearning for the end time. That has never been a feature of Scientology. Clearly, however, the lure of totalistic religious movements defies easy categorization. Such groups can arise anywhere and spread like viruses, and it is impossible to know which ones will turn lethal or why. Both the German government and the Scientologists viewed their struggle through the prism of Germany's Nazi past. Ursula Caberta, the head of the Hamburg Anti-Scientology Task Force, compared Hubbard's Introduction to Scientology Ethics to Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. Hitler was thinking that the Aryans were going to rule the world, the Untermenschen. The philosophy of L. Ron Hubbard is the same. In response to such statements, in January 1997, a group of Hollywood celebrities, agents, lawyers, and movie executives published a full-page open letter to Chancellor Helmut Kohl in the International Herald Tribune. Hitler made religious intolerance official government policy, the letter stated. In the 1930s, it was the Jews. Today, it is the Scientologists. The letter compared the boycotts of Cruz, Travolta, and Korea to Nazi book burnings. The letter was written and paid for by Bertram Fields, then the most powerful lawyer in Hollywood, whose clients included Travolta and Cruz. None of the 34 signatories of the document were Scientologists, but many were Jews. Most of them, such as Oliver Stone, Dustin Hoffman, and Goldie Hawn, had worked with the two stars, or were friends or clients of Fields. Entertainment Tonight sent the actress Ann Archer, a well-known Scientologist, to Germany on a fact-finding mission. She later testified before the U.S. Congress, as did other Scientology celebrities, Travolta, Correa, and Isaac Hayes, about the suppression of religious freedom in Germany. Individuals and businesses throughout Germany are routinely required to sign a declaration referred to as a sect filter, swearing that they are not Scientologists, Travolta told Congress. Failure to sign means that companies will not hire them, trade unions will not admit them, they will not be permitted to join social groups, banks will not open accounts for them, and they are even excluded from sports clubs solely because of their religion. In April, John Travolta met with President Bill Clinton at a conference on volunteerism in Philadelphia. It was a freighted moment for the president, since Travolta was portraying a character based on him in the forthcoming movie Primary Colors. He said he wanted to help me out with the situation in Germany, Travolta later said. He had a roommate years ago who was a Scientologist and had really liked him and respected his views on it. He said he felt we were given an unfair hand in that country and that he wanted to fix it. Clinton set up a meeting for Travolta and Cruz with Sandy Berger, his national security advisor, who was given the additional assignment of being the administration's Scientology point person. None of this had any effect on Travolta's character in the film, as the movie had already been shot, nor on Germany's policy toward the church, which refused to recognize Scientology as a religion or allow members to join political parties. However, the U.S. State Department began pressuring the German government on behalf of Scientology. The Germans were puzzled that their American counterparts seemed not to know or care about the church's RPF camps, which the Germans called penal colonies, and the reported practices of confinement, forced confessions, and punishing physical labor, which they said amounted to brainwashing. There was a belief within the German cabinet that the church's real goal was to infiltrate the government and create a Scientology superstate. This is not a church or a religious organization, the labor minister, Norbert Blum, told Maclean's magazine. Scientology is a machine for manipulating human beings. Chapter 8. Bohemian Rhapsody. Paul Haggis and Deborah Renard married in 1997, soon after Paul's divorce from Diane became final. Paul was still seeking joint custody of his three daughters. Without consulting him, Diane had taken Lauren and Katie out of Delphi Academy, apparently intending to enroll them in public school. Paul and Diane were ordered by the court to undergo psychiatric evaluation, a procedure that Scientology abhors. In December 1998, the court surprised everyone by awarding Paul full custody of his daughters. According to court records, the ruling followed the discovery that the girls were not enrolled in school at all. The girls were stunned. They had watched the hostilities through Diane's eyes. No one had prepared them for the possibility that they might be taken from her. Until then, it had been the three girls and their mother against the world. The girls thought the decision was unbalanced and unfairly influenced by the fact that their father had more money. Alyssa vowed she would never speak to him again. Haggis was also caught short by the court's decision. In addition to the year-old son, James, he had with Deborah, he suddenly had two teenage daughters on his hands as well. Alyssa was 21 at the time and lived on her own. The girls felt uprooted, and they missed the emotional support of their mother. They didn't resent Deborah. Actually, they appreciated her advocacy and the way she balanced out Paul. Still, it was a difficult adjustment for everyone. Paul put the girls in a private school, but that lasted only 6 months. They weren't entirely comfortable talking to people who weren't Scientologists, and basic things like multiple choice tests were unfamiliar. They demanded to be sent to a boarding institution on an isolated hilltop near Sheridan, Oregon, called the Delphian School, or the Mother School, as it was known to Scientologists. Alyssa had gone there when she was 14 years old. It had been a mixed experience for her. She had brought a copy of the autobiography of Malcolm X and books of 18th-century poetry, a CD of great speeches by Lincoln and Martin Luther King, and a pack of tarot cards. Although she loved the school, she never felt she fit in with the other kids. They wanted to talk about boys and pop culture, and she was more interested in philosophy and religion. But Delphian was just what Laura needed. She got intensive tutoring to help her overcome her educational deficits. However, she also began to come up against some of the constraints of her church. While she was at Delphian, Lauren decided to write a paper about religious intolerance. In particular, she felt that Scientology was under attack, and she couldn't understand why. When she went online to see what the opposition was saying, a fellow student turned her in to ethics. Lauren was told that Scientologists shouldn't look at negative stories about their religion. She was supposed to be saving the planet, so why was she wasting her time reading lies? Because of her isolation and the censorship imposed on her education, when Lauren finally graduated from high school at the age of 20, she had never heard anyone speak ill of Scientology, nor did she question the ban on research about her religion. She thought, "I guess I'm not supposed to do these things. I will stay away." Like her father, she learned it was easier not to look. Alyssa had a different issue. She didn't really date in high school, and by the time she got to junior college, it began to dawn on her that she was gay. She actually wasn't sure what that meant. She had two uncles who were gay, but for the longest time she didn't know what a lesbian was. Then her sister Katie, who is 5 years younger and had grown up in the internet-savvy culture, came out to her parents. Paul told Katie that there was no way that he would ever love her less. That made it easier for Alyssa to talk about what she was discovering about herself. The vow never to speak to her father again began to lose its hold on her. All the girls had grown up hearing prejudiced remarks from people in the church who saw homosexuality as an aberration that undermined the survival of the species. Gays themselves were seen as sinister perverts. These attitudes were informed by Hubbard's writings on the subject. But it wasn't just Scientology, Alyssa realized. The entire society was biased against homosexuals. In her early 20s, Alyssa finally found the courage to come out to her father. "Oh yeah, I already knew that," he told her. He said he wondered why she had ever dated boys in the first place. "You knew?" she said. "I didn't know. How did you know? Why didn't you tell me? You could have clued me in. It would have made it easier for me." That was so typical of her father. He was maddening in that way, completely accepting but disengaged, as if it really didn't matter one way or the other. To signify her newfound identity, Alyssa got a tattoo of her favorite Latin poem, the opening line of Carmen 5 by Catullus. Vivamus mea lesbia atque amemus. Let us live, my lesbia, and let us love. It snaked all the way down her left arm. Ever since the Time expose, the church had been frantically trying to recover Tom Cruise. Both Cruise and Nicole Kidman were attaining ever greater success. Cruise became the first actor to star in 5 consecutive films to gross more than $100 million in the United States, including Jerry Maguire and the first Mission Impossible. Kidman was also gaining international renown with her roles in Batman Forever and To Die For. They gave the impression that they were putting Scientology behind them. In 1996, Marty Rathbun had gone to Los Angeles to audit Cruise, but that one session went nowhere. According to Rathbun, Miscavige blamed Nicole Kidman and viewed her as a gold digger who was faking Scientology. He says that Miscavige was hopeful that if they portrayed Nicole Kidman as a suppressive person, Cruise could be peeled away from her. It was 2 years before Cruise agreed to go through another bout of auditing. This time, strict secrecy was imposed. Worried about scaring off the tentative star, Rathbun arranged the sessions so that even top officials in the church were unaware that Cruz was receiving services. For 5 days in October 1998, Cruz drove into a private parking lot in the back of the historic Guarantee Building on Hollywood Boulevard, with the yellow Scientology sign atop it that looms over the fabled district. Charlie Chaplin and Rudolph Valentino used to have their offices here. Now the lobby is a shrine to the life and works of L. Ron Hubbard. A giant bust of the founder greets the occasional visitor. Embedded in the sidewalk in front of the building are the stars of bygone celebrities on the Hollywood Walk of Fame: Otto Kruger, Tony Martin, Ann Rutherford, Richard Carlson, Jetta Goodall, Paul Winchell, who had their own moments of great renown and are now largely forgotten. Cruz went in a back door that led to a basement hallway. There was an elevator at the end of the hallway that went directly to the secret 11th floor, where both Miscavige and Rathbun maintained offices. The World Series was underway, New York versus San Diego, and Cruz wore his Yankees hat. He was not in good shape, spiritually or mentally, Rathbun observed. He was personally very interbulated. After that episode of auditing, Cruz went quiet again. He and Kidman were in England filming Eyes Wide Shut for Stanley Kubrick. In any case, Rathbun and Miscavige had their hands full, fending off the lawsuits and reporters swirling around the McPherson case. Rathbun said that in January 2001, he got a call from Cruz asking for help. Cruz said that he and Kidman were finished. Cruz never offered a public explanation for the divorce, and Kidman herself was clearly surprised by his decision. She later revealed that she had suffered a miscarriage 2 months after Cruz moved out, and she had asked the doctors to preserve samples of the fetus's DNA to prove that Cruz was the father. She pleaded with him to undergo marriage counseling at the church. Cruz refused, publicly declaring, "Nick knows exactly why we are getting a divorce." This was a decisive moment in Cruz's relationship with Scientology. Rathbun provided the star with more than 200 hours of auditing over the next couple of years. From July through Thanksgiving 2001, Rathbun was with Cruz at the Celebrity Center frequently, doing auditing rundowns and the PTS/SP, Potential Trouble Source/Suppressive Persons, course. He paired Cruz with another actor, Jason Begay, to do training drills. For instance, Begay would think of a hypothetical date, which Cruz had to figure out using the E-meter, an exercise Cruz found really frustrating. A young man named Tommy Davis began acting as Rathbun's assistant. He brought sandwiches and helped out with Cruz's children, making sure they were receiving church services. Despite his youth, Davis was already a unique figure in the church. He was a second-generation Scientologist, a Sea Org member, and the scion of the Hollywood elite. His mother was Ann Archer, a talented and popular actress who had starred in a number of movies, including Patriot Games and Fatal Attraction, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award. She had been a deeply committed Scientologist since she began studying with Milton Katselis at the Beverly Hills Playhouse in her 20s. She had always been proud to associate herself with Scientology in public, speaking at innumerable events on behalf of the church. Her son Tommy embodied the aspiration of the church to establish itself in the Hollywood community. Indeed, he was living proof that it had done so. He had known Cruz since he was 18 years old, so it was natural that he soon became the church's liaison with the star, reporting directly to Shelley Miscavige. He had a relationship with Cruz similar to the one that Spanky Taylor once enjoyed with John Travolta. Rathbun assigned Davis to sit with Cruz in the parking lot of Home Depot in Hollywood while the star was doing his tone scale drills, guessing the emotional state of random people coming out of the store. Cruz then took a break to promote his movie Vanilla Sky. The following February through April 2002, Cruz and Rathbun were once again working together full-time, mostly at Gold Base. Cruz was preparing for his role in The Last Samurai, directed by Ed Zwick, and between sessions with Rathbun, he would go into the courtyard to practice his sword play. Cruz had begun dating the Spanish actress Penelope Cruz, and in the fall of 2001, Rathbun began auditing her as well. At the same time, he was still acting as Nicole Kidman's ethics officer in the church, even though she and Cruz were engaged in a bitter divorce proceeding. One of the issues was whether the children would be educated in schools using the Hubbard method, which Kidman opposed. That was another battle she lost. Although Tom and Nicole split custody of their children, both Isabella and Connor soon chose to live exclusively with their father. Rathbun says this was because the Scientology staff, especially Tommy Davis, quietly worked to turn the children against Kidman. Tommy told them over and over again their mother was a sociopath, and after a while they believed him, he recalled. They had daily sessions with Tommy. I was there. I saw it. According to several former Sea Org members, Rathbun's auditing sessions with Cruz were videotaped. Tom DeVocht, a former church official, said Miscavige would watch them and then regale his inner circle over his nightly whiskey with stories of Cruz's confessions, dwelling especially on his sex life. Footnote: the church denies that Cruz was videotaped or that Miscavige watched such tapes or used such information to manipulate anyone. Noriyuki Matsumaru, who worked in the RTC with Miscavige, confirms DeVocht's account. End footnote. Rathbun was opposed to the endless courtship of Cruz. In his opinion, there was no need for it once Cruz was securely back on the bridge. Rathbun told Miscavige, "I think I'm done with this guy." Miscavige responded, "He'll be done when he calls me." The leader was galled by the fact that Cruz had never contacted him when he came back for counseling. Rathbun continually urged Cruz to call COB, as Miscavige is known in the church, chairman of the board. At one point, Cruz asked for Miscavige's number, but then failed to call. His tentativeness was worrisome. Whatever restraint Cruz felt about Miscavige eventually fell away, however, and Miscavige was once again folded into the star's inner circle. There were movie nights in Cruz's mansion. Miscavige flew with Cruz in the Warner Brothers jet to a test screening of The Last Samurai in Arizona. The two men became closer than ever. Cruz later said of Miscavige, "I have never met a more competent, a more intelligent, a more compassionate being outside of what I have experienced from LRH. And I've met the leaders of leaders. I've met them all." Cruz's renewed dedication to Scientology permanently changed the relationship between the church and the Hollywood celebrity community. Cruz poured millions of dollars into the church, $3 million in 2004 alone. He was not simply a figurehead. He was an activist with an international following. He could take the church into places it had never been before. Whenever Cruz traveled abroad to promote his movies, he used the opportunity to lobby foreign leaders and American ambassadors to promote Scientology. Davis usually accompanied him on these diplomatic and lobbying missions. Cruz repeatedly consulted with former President Clinton, lobbying him to get Prime Minister Tony Blair's help in getting the Church of Scientology declared a tax-deductible charitable organization in the United Kingdom. Rathbun was present for one telephone call in which Clinton advised Cruz he would be better served by contacting Blair's wife, Cherie, rather than the Prime Minister, because she was a lawyer and would understand the details. Later, Cruz went to London, where he met with a couple of Blair's representatives, although nothing came of those efforts. In 2003, he met with Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage and Vice President Dick Cheney's Chief of Staff, Scooter Libby, to express the church's concerns over its treatment in Germany. Cruz had access to practically anyone in the world. That same year, Cruz and Davis lobbied Rod Page, the Secretary of Education during the first term of President George W. Bush, to endorse Hubbard's study tech educational methods. Page had been impressed. For months, Cruz kept in contact with Page's office, urging that Scientology techniques be folded into the president's No Child Left Behind program. One day, Cruz flew his little red and white striped Pitts special biplane, designed for aerobatics, to Hemet, along with his Scientologist chief of staff, Michael Doven. Miscavige and Rathbun picked them up and drove them to Gold Base. Rathbun was in the back seat and recalls Cruz boasting to COB about his talks with the secretary. "Bush may be an idiot," Miscavige observed, "but I wouldn't mind his being our Constantine." Cruz agreed. "If fucking Arnold can be governor, I could be president." Miscavige responded, "Well, absolutely, Tom." Footnote. Cruz, through his lawyer, denies this exchange and says he has no political ambition. End footnote. In 2001, Haggis was fired from Family Law, the show he had created. His career, which for so long seemed to be a limitless staircase toward fame and fortune, now took a plunge. He began working at home. Within a week, he started writing a movie script called Million Dollar Baby, based on a series of short stories by F.X. Toole. He spent a year working on it, drawing upon some of his own painful memories. He identified with the character of a sour old boxing coach, Frankie Dunn. Like Haggis, Frankie is estranged from his daughter. His letters to her are returned. He turns to religion, going to Mass every day and seeking a forgiveness that he doesn't really believe in. Into the coach's dismal life comes another young woman, Maggie Fitzgerald, an aspiring boxer from a white trash background. All of the loss and longing he feels for his daughter is apparent in his mentoring of this gritty young fighter who has more faith in him than he has in himself. But Maggie is paralyzed when her neck is broken in a fight. In a climactic moment, she begs Frankie to pull the plug and let her die. Haggis faced a similar choice in real life with his best friend, who is brain dead from a staph infection. "They don't die easily," he recalled. "Even in a coma, he kicked and moaned for 12 hours. Haggis dreamed of directing the movie himself, but as much as studios admired the writing, the story was so dark, nobody wanted to get near it. Haggis began borrowing money to stay afloat. He turned down another TV series because he realized that his heart hadn't been in television for years. One of his abandoned TV projects still haunted him. The idea sprang from an unsettling incident a decade before, when he and Diane were driving home from the premiere of Silence of the Lambs. Paul was wearing a tuxedo and driving a Porsche convertible. He stopped at a Blockbuster video store on Wilshire Boulevard to rent some obscure Dutch film. When they got back into the car, two young black men with guns suddenly rushed up to them. The robbers ordered them out of the car and told them to walk toward a dark parking lot. That seemed like a really bad idea. Haggis pretended not to hear them. He put Diane in front of him and headed down Wilshire instead. "Stop!" Paul and Diane froze. They heard footsteps, and one of the thieves snatched the video out of Diane's hand. Then the Porsche roared off. That was the last Haggis ever saw of it. 10 years later, Haggis awakened in the middle of the night and began chewing over this frightening episode once again. He often thought about it. The entire experience had lasted less than a minute, but it had colored his stance toward life in complicated ways. Where did these kids come from? They were living in the same city as he, but a universe of race and class separated them. He could imagine who he was in their eyes, just some rich white guy with much more than his share of what life had to offer. In a way, Haggis was on their side. But it could have turned out so much worse. Guns always make things dangerously unpredictable. He was shaken by that thought. The unexpected coda of snatching the rented videotape was intriguing. Haggis had managed a wisecrack to the cops at the time. "I think you'll discover that these men have been here quite often looking for that video, and it was never in." Specifically, what he thought about in the middle of the night was what those kids said to each other as they sped out of the Blockbuster parking lot onto Wilshire in his pearlescent cabriolet. Could he find himself in them? Haggis got out of bed and began writing. By mid-morning, he had a lengthy outline. It was about the manifold ways that people interact with each other, how the experience of having someone honk at you in traffic and shoot you the finger can affect your mood, so that you take it out on someone else at the first opportunity, or how, alternatively, someone lets you into a long line of traffic and your day brightens. He saw life in America as a volatile collision of cultures, of immigrants who fail to read the codes that underlie our system, of races that resent and mistrust each other, of people coexisting in different social strata who look at each other with uncomprehending fear and hatred. He had shopped the proposal around to different television producers, but they unanimously passed on it. Now, as he was struggling financially and artistically, Deborah suggested he consider writing the script as a movie. "You'll win an Academy Award," she told him. Haggis contacted his friend Robert Moresco, who had been a writer on Haggis's series Easy Streets. He told Moresco, "I don't think anybody's going to make this, but it's a great story." The two men began working in Haggis's home office next to the laundry room. They wrote a first draft in 2 weeks. Haggis decided to call it Crash. The title refers to a fender bender that sets off a chain of events revealing the contradictory elements of the characters and the city they inhabit. In the dizzying seconds after the collision, an LAPD detective suddenly realizes what's missing in his life. "It's the sense of touch," he says in the movie's opening lines. "In L.A., no one touches you. We're always behind metal and glass. Think we miss that touch so much we crash into each other just to feel something." Haggis insists on turning his heroes into villains and vice versa, such as the racist white cop who molests a tony, upper-class black woman in one scene, then saves her life in another. Haggis felt that by exploring such complexities, he was teasing out the dark and light threads of his own personality. For the next year and a half, he struggled to get the movie greenlit. He was still a first-time movie director, and that posed an obstacle. Moreover, the script called for an ensemble cast with no single starring role, always an obstacle in Hollywood. Haggis finally interested a producer, Bob Yari, who agreed to make the movie for $10 million if Haggis could assemble a star-studded cast. Don Cheadle was the first to sign on, both as an actor and a producer, and his name added credibility to the project. Matt Dillon and Tony Danza came aboard. Heath Ledger and John Cusack agreed to work for scale, as everyone did. Still, the project dragged on. Finally, Haggis was told the movie was a go. He then sent the script to John Travolta and Kelly Preston, who he thought would be perfect as the district attorney and his wife. "That's great, because now we really need them," one of the producers, Kathy Schulman, told him the next day. Heath Ledger had dropped out, and Cusack was not far behind. Once again, the movie would need more big-name stars to get the financing. Haggis immediately sent a note to Preston, telling her he was withdrawing his offer. As a matter of pride, he felt it was wrong to use his friends in such a way, especially other Scientologists. Preston was miffed, since he had failed to explain his decision. But without two more signature names, the movie was back in limbo. Haggis was about to lose Cheadle as well, because he was scheduled to make Hotel Rwanda. Yari finally told Haggis to shut the production down. The following Monday, when Shulman came into the production office, she found Haggis there alone. "What are you doing?" she asked. "I'm prepping the movie." Yari agreed to keep the office open for one more week, and then another, as each Monday Shulman would find Haggis at work preparing for a movie that now had no budget at all. Gradually, other people began working with him for no pay. "If you get Sandy Bullock, you got a green light," Shulman told him. Haggis got Sandra Bullock for the role of the district attorney's wife, a brittle, racist socialite, a role far from the plucky gamines she had played in the past. In the movie, she's the one who gets carjacked at gunpoint, but the producers wanted one more name, Brendan Fraser. Haggis thought he was much too young for the part, as did Fraser, but he agreed to do it. The movie was finally greenlit just 4 weeks before the shooting started. Only now, the $10 million had shrunk to $6.5 million. For Haggis, everything was riding on this film. He mortgaged his house 3 times. He also used it as a set in order to save on his location budget. He canceled many of the exterior scenes and borrowed the set of the television show Monk to film interiors. He was eating carelessly and smoking constantly. He lost weight. He desperately needed more time. When he finished shooting a scene in Chinatown, Kathy Shulman caught up with him to ask about the next day's shoot. "You look like you're clutching your chest," she observed. Haggis admitted that he was having some pains. "Sharp pains?" Shulman urged him to see a doctor. He didn't want to hear that. He went home. He woke the next morning in agony. He called his doctor, who told him it was probably stress, but agreed to see him just to set his mind at ease. By now, Paul was short of breath, so Deborah drove him to the doctor's office. The doctor did a few tests and said, yes, it was stress and muscle fatigue, but we'll do an electrocardiogram just in case. A few moments later, the doctor returned. His face was snow white. "Don't stand up," he said in a professionally measured voice. "You've had a heart attack." That night in the hospital, Haggis suffered another cardiac failure. He received 3 stents in the arteries to his heart in an emergency operation. He was able to watch the entire procedure on the monitor. It was really like an out-of-body experience, watching his own fragile heart being repaired. The movie he was making didn't seem so important anymore. That changed as soon as the operation was over. Shulman arrived with some more bad news. "I talked to your doctor," she told Haggis. "He's not going to allow you to go back to work for another 4 or 5 months. I've got to hire another director." "Fine," Haggis responded. He said he'd talk it over with his doctor. The doctor confirmed the decision. "Paul, it's not just your heart attack," he told him. "You've had an operation. It'll put too much stress on your heart." "I totally understand," Haggis replied. "Let me ask you how much stress you think I would be experiencing if I were just sitting at home while another director is finishing my fucking film." Production was shut down for 1.5 weeks until Haggis returned with a nurse at his side who checked his vital signs every 1/4 hour. Sandra Bullock brought him green tea and refused to let him drink coffee. Every time Haggis tried to stand up, she told him to sit down. She had a kind of implacable maternal authority. He finished the film in his chair with a cup of tea in his hands. Clint Eastwood had been asked to read Million Dollar Baby for the role of Frankie Dunn, the boxing coach. He loved the script, but said he would only do the role if he could direct as well. Although Haggis hated to surrender the opportunity to direct, he knew it would be a bigger picture if Eastwood were behind it. Hilary Swank was cast as Maggie Fitzgerald, a part that would bring her an Academy Award. Morgan Freeman also would win in a supporting role, and Eastwood for directing. All that in addition to winning the Oscar for Best Picture. Haggis would be nominated for Best Screenplay, but that was still on the horizon. While he was still editing Crash, Haggis began writing another movie for Eastwood, Flags of Our Fathers. They went to visit the producer of that project, Steven Spielberg, on the set of War of the Worlds, which he was shooting with Tom Cruise. Spielberg had called Haggis to talk over an idea for another script. Haggis had met Cruise on a couple of occasions, once at a fundraiser and again at the Celebrity Center. As the most popular and sought-after leading man in Hollywood, Cruise was given perks that few other stars could match. He had asked Tommy Davis, now his full-time Scientology handler, to set up a tent on the set of War of the Worlds in order to distribute church materials to the crew and provide Scientology assists. The precedent alarmed many in Hollywood, and Spielberg was widely criticized for letting it happen. "It's really remarkable to me," Spielberg observed, as he and Haggis walked to his trailer. "I've met all these Scientologists, and they seem like the nicest people."
"Yeah, we keep all the evil ones in the closet," Haggis replied.
Footnote: Spielberg's publicist says that the director doesn't recall the conversation. End footnote. A couple of days later, Tommy Davis called Haggis at home and told him someone from senior management needed to see him urgently. Haggis had no idea what was going on. He assumed that the church was going to pressure him to take some more auditing or another course, as had happened so often in the past. Davis met him at the Celebrity Center and escorted him to a room where Greg Wilhere was waiting. Wilhere, a handsome former college football player, was a senior executive in the church assigned to be Cruise's personal auditor. He accompanied the star even to the shooting of Days of Thunder, where a character in the movie was named after him. Wilhere was livid because Haggis had upset Tom Cruise by subverting years of work on Cruise's part to recruit Spielberg into the church. "It was a joke," Haggis protested. He said he had no idea how that could have undermined Cruise's efforts to draw the most powerful man in Hollywood into Scientology. Wilhere said that Steven was having a problem with one of his seven children, and Tom was working to steer him in the right direction. "All that was ruined," Wilhere said, "because Spielberg now believed there were evil Scientologists who were locked in a closet." Haggis felt like he was trapped in a farce. It all seemed wildly ridiculous, but he was the only one who thought so. Still, he'd be crazy to antagonize Tom Cruise and Steven Spielberg. He offered to explain to Spielberg that he had been kidding. There were no evil Scientologists, and if there were, they wouldn't be kept in a closet. He couldn't believe that Spielberg would actually think he had been serious. Wilhere was unappeased. He said Cruise was apoplectic. He directed Haggis to write the star a letter of apology. This minute. Haggis dutifully wrote out a note on the paper handed to him, but Wilhere said it wasn't sufficient. Haggis wrote a more contrite note. Wilhere said he would pass it along, but Haggis never got a response from Cruise. Footnote: Tom Cruise's lawyer says that the actor doesn't remember the incident or his being upset with Haggis. End footnote. Haggis came away from that meeting with a new appreciation of the significance of Tom Cruise to Scientology. He had heard that Cruise had often been enlisted to try to recruit famous people. They included James Packer, the richest man in Australia, David Beckham, the British soccer star, and his wife Victoria, the former Spice Girl, and Cruise's good friends, the actors Will and Jada Pinkett Smith, who later funded a school that used Hubbard educational techniques. But there was no one else like Spielberg. Had Cruise been successful in his efforts, it would have been a transformative moment in the history of the church, especially in its relation to Hollywood. It would have given reality to the mythology of Scientology's influence in the entertainment industry. Who could guess how many recruits would flood into the church because of Spielberg's imprimatur?
or how much money would pour into Scientology's coffers by moguls and agents and aspiring movie stars seeking to gain favor. The ambition behind such a play on the part of the church was breathtaking, and Haggis had stepped into the middle of it with an innocent jest. Cruz turned his attention to the other Scientologists in the industry. Many had gone quiet following the scandals in the church or had never openly admitted their affiliation with the church. Cruz called a meeting of other Scientology celebrities and urged them to become more outspoken about their religion. The popular singer Beck, who had grown up in the church, subsequently began speaking openly about his faith. Erica Christensen, a rising young actress who was also a second-generation Scientologist, called Cruz her spiritual mentor. Inspired by a new sense of activism, a group of Scientology actors turned against Milton Katselas, the gray eminence of the Beverly Hills Playhouse. No one had been more instrumental in forging the bond between Scientology and Hollywood. Katselas had been a longtime friend of Hubbard's and still kept a photograph of him on his desk. The two men were similar in many ways, but especially in their transformative effect on those who studied under them. Humorous, compassionate, and charismatic, but also vain and demanding, Katselas was not above bullying his students to make a point. However, many of them felt that he had taken them to a higher level of artistry than they had ever thought they could achieve. When Katselas addressed an acting student, it wasn't just about technique. His lessons were full of savvy observations about life and behavior. One of those students, Alan Barton, was a classical pianist as well as a promising actor. When Katselas heard him play, he found him a teacher and paid for his piano lessons. Barton eventually arranged a recital on a Sunday evening. Katselas showed up at the theater at 8 that morning, just as the piano was being delivered. He noticed that the stage was scratched. There were piled-up boxes spilling out of the wings, and a large spiral staircase, a prop from an old production, was left on the stage because it was simply too big to move. Barton explained that he was going to cover up as much as possible with black drapes. Katselas called his office, and within an hour, 10 people arrived. He sent Barton off to relax and prepare himself for the performance. When Barton returned that afternoon, the staircase was gone, the boxes had disappeared, the stage had been sanded and painted, and 4 trees surrounded the piano. Even the pots the trees were planted in had been painted to match the backdrop. The overall effect was stunning. "Have a good show," Katselas said, and walked away. Overwhelmed, Barton ran after him. "How can I ever thank you?" he asked. As he drove off, Katselas said, "Learn to expect it of yourself." Such stories became a part of the Katselas legend. He was an OT5 and a very public Scientologist, but he had stopped moving up the bridge in part because he refused to travel to FLAG, where the upper-level courses were offered. Moreover, he had gotten into ethics trouble because of his behavior with some of his female students. Jenna Elfman was a leader of the revolt against Katselas. She had been one of his prize students, winning a Golden Globe Award in 1999 for her free-spirited performance in the sitcom Dharma and Greg. Alan Barton, who had become a teacher at the Playhouse, wrote Elfman a letter in June 2004, begging her to relent. He called the movement against Katselas Scientological McCarthyism. Harking back to the blacklisting of Hollywood celebrities in the 1950s because of their supposed communist sympathies. As Scientologists, are we now a group that blacklists, that casts aside friendships and alliances on the basis of how fast someone is moving up the bridge? He wrote. If we as a group are going to take on the billions of wogs out in the world, how can we disconnect from each other? Elfman never responded. After Cruz rallied the Scientology celebrities, a group of students demanded that Katselas make the Playhouse a wise business. The acronym stands for World Institute of Scientology Enterprises. Katselis refused, even though he lost 100 students in a mass Scientology walkout. Many of them went to another school, the Acting Center, which was founded in 2006, based in part on Scientology techniques. Katselis died of heart failure in 2008, and the Beverly Hills Playhouse is no longer connected with the church. The long line of protégés that Katselis left behind cemented the association between the church and the Hollywood acting community, but in the end, he was ostracized by the very people whose careers he had nurtured. Tom Cruise was now considered the unofficial ethics officer of Hollywood. He was the embodiment of Hubbard's vision of a church with temples dedicated to celebrity rather than God. Cruise's intensity and commitment, along with his spectacular ambition, matched Miscavige's own. It was as if Miscavige had rubbed a magic lantern and Cruise had appeared, a genie who could open any door. He was one of the few people that Miscavige saw as a peer. Miscavige even wondered if there was some way to appoint Cruise the church's inspector general for ethics, Rathbun's job. He'd say that Tom Cruise was the only person in Scientology other than himself that he would trust to run the church, one former Sea Org member recalled. Rathbun observed, "Miscavige convinced Cruise that he and Tom were two of only a handful of truly big beings on the planet. He instructed Cruise that LRH was relying upon them to unite with the few others of their ilk on Earth, to make it onto Target 2, some unspecified galactic locale where they would meet up with Hubbard in the afterlife." Haggis had also been folded into the celebrity recruitment apparatus. He had put his money and his reputation in the hands of the church. He, too, was serving Scientology. But he rarely spoke about his affiliation to his employees or associates. Even his close friends were surprised to learn that he was in the church. He didn't have that sort of straight-on, unambiguous, unambivalent view that so many Scientologists project into the world, Marshall Herskovitz observed. For years, Herskovitz and several of Haggis's closest non-Scientology friends participated in an irregular Friday get-together called Boys' Night. They met at an Italian restaurant on Montana Avenue in Santa Monica. The actor Josh Brolin usually attended, along with director Oliver Stone, producer Stephen Nathan, and a peace activist and former priest named Blaise Bonpain, among others. One night, an attractive New York Times reporter came to write about the event, and the men decided that she made them all a lot more appealing than they were on other occasions. After that, they voted to invite one woman to join them whenever they met. Usually, it's a beautiful actress. Julie Delpy and Charlize Theron have both been accorded this honor. Madeline Stowe recalled it as the funniest evening she had ever had, although she had the sense to bring her husband along. She remembered Haggis sitting back, wisecracking, smoking a cigarette, watching it all happen. Although Brolin, Nathan, and Stone are three of Haggis's closest male friends, they never talked to him about Scientology. And yet each of the three had an experience in the church, which the others weren't aware of. Steve Nathan had been hooked up to an e-meter in the late 1960s, by some British Scientologists who were looking for recruits, but he hadn't been impressed. Oliver Stone didn't even know Haggis was in Scientology, but for that matter, few knew that Stone had also spent a month in the church. He was a young man, just back from Vietnam, full of trouble and questions. He signed up at the church's New York Center in the old Hotel Martinique. It was like going to college and reading Dale Carnegie, something you do to find yourself. The difference was that in Scientology there were nice parties and beautiful girls. Scientology didn't answer his questions, but on the other hand, he noted, "I got laid." Brolin had known Haggis for many years. They had worked together in television, and Brolin had helped with Haggis's charities. Brolin and his wife, actress Diane Lane, shared a house in Italy during the summers with Paul and Deborah. One evening, lubricated with grappa, Brolin began recounting a story of a friend who had infiltrated Scientology. He wondered why Paul and Deborah were listening stony-faced. When he finished the tale, Deborah finally said, "You know, we're Scientologists." "What?" Brolin exclaimed. "When the fuck did that happen?" "A long time ago," Deborah said. "I am so sorry. I had no idea," Brolin said.